Hi everyone, welcome back to another episode of Micro News, the sister series of Microbe Talk, where myself and Laura
Hello.
Discuss all the times microbiology has been in the news this month.
On this month's episode, we're going to be discussing glowing microbes, ancient microbes, microbes in elk, and microbes in the brain. Right, let's get started. Researchers from University College London have been testing the bacteria in London's freshwater canals, ponds and rivers. The team, led by Microbiology Society member Dr. Lena Sirik, who is no stranger to us here on Microbe Talk, went searching for the genes that help bacteria survive antibiotic treatments in environmental microbes. According to the research, there were bacteria resistant to antibiotics like penicillin, erythromycin and tetracycline in the Regent's Canal, Regent's Park Pond and the Serpentine. But the River Thames was the water source that had the highest levels of AMR genes by far. That might be because a lot of treated wastewater is released into the Thames. The other water sources that were tested, not so much. Wastewater treatment removes organic matter and the majority of bacteria from water, making it clean and ready to reuse or release into the environment. What the current process for wastewater treatment in the UK doesn't do is remove antibiotics or antimicrobial resistant genes, meaning a lot of antibiotics are being released into environmental water sources. As well as this meaning more and more microbes are being exposed to antibiotics, which could encourage them to develop resistance, it also favours the reproduction of already resistant bacteria, as they have less competition for resources from bacteria which may have been killed off by the antibiotics. What Lena and her colleagues hope their research will do is raise awareness of the importance of removing antimicrobials from wastewater during treatment, and suggest other forms of wastewater treatment, such as slow sand filtration, are used going forwards.
So my first story is also concerning freshwater. I know you do a lot of kayaking in freshwater, Laura, so I'm afraid this might not be a good story for you. This new story is a story about amoeba. For those who haven't heard of amoeba or are unsure what they are, they're single cellular organisms that can change their shape. They're not one taxonomic group, but occur amongst protozoa, fungi, algae, and animals. This new story concerns one particular amoeba, rather nastily known as the brain-eating amoeba. Now, sadly, the name explains exactly what the species does. The species, known as Naegleria fowleri, enters the body through the nose and migrates up the olfactory nerve to the brain and destroys the tissue. The risk of infection increases when fresh water warms up, and in this case, a man was swimming in a water park in North Carolina in the States and got infected.
So, is it safe to kayak in fresh water?
There's good news and not so good news. If a person does get infected by the amoeba, it's not good news. The mortality rate is incredibly high. Only 4 people in a recorded 145 cases survived. But the good news is it's incredibly rare. Those 145 cases were the only cases between 1962 and 2019 in the United States. So I think your kayaking can continue.
Those cases that you were talking about just now, they're from the United States. Is this amoeba in UK freshwater as well?
I'm not 100% sure. All of the cases I could find were in the States, and it's usually found in warmer waters, and as we don't really have that in the UK, might not be so much a problem, but I wouldn't really want to say either way.
So my second story this week is about a piece that was in The Telegraph discussing the factors contributing to the global rise of dengue fever. Dengue is a virus spread by the mosquito Aedes aegypti, which also spreads other diseases, including yellow fever and Zika. Viruses spread by mosquitoes and other arthropods are called arboviruses. According to the article, in South America there have been 1.6 million cases of dengue so far this year, mostly in Brazil. In addition, the government in Nicaragua have issued an alert due to the surge in cases, and neighbouring Honduras is facing its worst outbreak in the past 50 years. Back in the 1970s, dengue only really affected 9 countries. Now there are over 100 countries with endemic dengue, and half of the world's population are at risk from the virus. So, what exactly has changed? A number of factors have made it easier for the virus to spread. A lot of it is to do with there being more people closer together, as populations have increased and previously rural areas have become urbanised, meaning there's a higher chance of being bitten by a dengue-carrying mosquito. A warming climate has also played a role, with mosquitoes able to breed more quickly and the virus able to replicate faster. International travel has carried the disease across borders, with dengue becoming increasingly common in Southeast Asia, and researchers are concerned that the virus will become more common in North America, the Mediterranean, and parts of Africa, where the Aedes aegypti mosquito is already present.
How do you treat dengue? Is there a vaccine or...?
It's proving quite difficult to get under control. There are 4 strains of dengue, meaning producing an effective treatment is complicated. At the moment, the most promising control method is releasing mosquitoes infected with a bacteria called Wolbachia in areas with high burden of disease.
Is Wolbachia the bacteria that stops mosquitoes from being able to transmit viruses?
Exactly. It protects the insect from viruses, including dengue, and also has another really cool function where it manipulates the sex of mosquitoes to become female.
That is cool.
This has a 2-pronged effect on the spread of diseases like dengue, meaning that the virus is not spread as frequently and mosquito populations fall due to the lack of males for reproduction.
My second story this month is from an area some of our listeners may not have heard of, and that's probably because we don't really know much about them. Prions are misfolded proteins that are contagious and can cause disease. They cause BSE or mad cow disease, which is pretty well known. This story concerns a different disease, however, which is called chronic wasting disease, or CWD. It's a prion disease that affects the deer family or cervids, such as moose, caribou, and elk. The disease is pretty nasty, as it's progressive and always fatal. Symptoms start with movement difficulties, and then the animals consistently show weight loss over time and behavioural changes such as tremors, nervousness, and listlessness. Most cervids that contract the disease also drink and urinate more, which can lead to the increased spread and leads me nicely into the story. So, Oregon is a state with a fair amount of hunting, and although CWD hasn't yet been detected there, it has been detected in nearby states and in captive cervid centres. Often hunters use deer or elk urine scent lures to attract deer or elk to the area. The worry is that as prions can bind to the soil material and remain infectious for a long time in the environment, it could easily spread if the scent lure is infected. Most scent lures come from captive cervids, and as they are considered a higher risk for CWD, Oregon State has banned the use of scent lures completely just to be on the safe side.
So if a hunter has already bought some scent lures, does that mean they have to throw them away?
Well, yes. So Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has said it's very important that it's not poured down the drain or in the ground or just thrown away, because that completely defeats the point of not using them. They can still get into the environment. So they can take it to the local offices where they're incinerated.
And incinerating a prion gets rid of it, does it?
Yeah, about 1800 degrees.
So if I put a prion in an oven, it would probably die.
Does your oven go up to 1800 degrees?
No, but that brings me on nicely to my next story, which is about bread. An ancient yeast has been used to make bread for what could be the first time in 5,000 years. Seamus Blackley, amateur Egyptologist and baking enthusiast, enlisted the help of microbiologists from the University of Iowa to collect dormant yeast from Egyptian beer and bread-making vessels. Yeasts have changed a lot, but so have grasses and grains like wheat. To make sure his bread was as close to the breads made in ancient Egypt, Seamus used ancient grains that the yeast would have been more likely to have encountered before. So this yeast was collected from a ceramic pot from the Old Kingdom, which was around 3200 BC, and Seamus is planning on working with museum collectors to collect yeast from other ceramic pots made between 500 to 1000 years later during the Middle and New Kingdoms. By doing this, they hope to see how the bread and yeast changed, and will also genetically sequence the yeasts to see how they've evolved over time.
That doesn't sound like it's going to win Bake Off. What did it taste like?
According to Seamus, the bread is sweeter than a modern sourdough and has a caramel aroma. Apparently the structure of the bread is quite cake-like and it's very soft.
Sounds good.
Yeah, there are some pictures on Seamus's Twitter and on the news stories too. The bread looks like a typical loaf to me, but Seamus scored in the Egyptian hieroglyph for bread on the top.
Cool. I've saved my favourite story to last, as I trained as a marine biologist, so I think this is really cool. Bioluminescence is when organisms produce and emit light. It works by a light-emitting molecule called luciferin being broken down by an enzyme called luciferase. Some organisms, such as fireflies, can produce light themselves, but often the organism has a symbiotic relationship with bioluminescent microbes. For example, Hawaiian bobtail squid have a symbiotic relationship with Alevibrio fischeri. But of the over 220,000 named species in our oceans, there are millions more we haven't discovered, but of those we have, what percentage would you say glowed?
Maybe 50%.
Close. It turns out over 75% of ocean animals have some form of bioluminescence. As far as adaptations go in the ocean, the ability to create light is apparently essential. The article this story comes from is by National Geographic, and it says it's so important that the trait has evolved 27 times among ray-finned fishes.
Why is it so important?
Because it's just got so many uses. It's used to defend against predators, to camouflage against predators, but also for predators themselves to act as a lure. They can stun their prey, attract mates. There are so many uses for it. Bioluminescence made a starring role in Finding Nemo, the anglerfish.
That actually reminds me of a practical I did in my first year of uni, where we inserted the P-GLO gene into E. coli. And once we'd got the gene into the bacteria, it meant that the colonies would glow under UV light.
Oh, which cool. Was fun.
And that's all we have time for this month. We hope you've enjoyed the episode, and let us know what you think by leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. And don't forget, there are links to all of the stories we've been talking about in the podcast description below. If you see any stories you think should be included in next month's episode, let us know on Twitter. Thanks for listening to Microbe Talk.